welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, I'm Jen, and this is Turn the Page, the official podcast of Syosset Public Library, and I'd like to introduce you to this week's guests. Could I ask you to introduce yourselves and your book in your own words, please?
I'm David Perry. I'm a journalist and historian. I'm an academic advisor in the history department at the University of Minnesota, and I'm one of the authors of The Bright Ages, A New History of Medieval Europe.
And I'm Matthew Gabriel. I am a professor of medieval studies and chair of the Department of Religion and Culture at Virginia Tech, and I'm the other author of The Bright Ages.
So I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about your research backgrounds, about what you've studied and what you've written before this book, and how you came to write this book together.
Sure. So, I mean, David and I have known each other for a really long time. We became friends because we were both medievalists. We both kind of study not just the Middle Ages generally, but kind of the same specific subfield, things related to the Crusades or religious violence in the Middle Ages. So I think we met at conferences or something like that. Like it's a little bit hard to kind of, it's back in the mists of time, wherever that is. So we had talked a little bit about, kind of how, not just how the Crusades, but how the Middle Ages are kind of remembered in today's world. And not just in popular culture, but in academic culture and things like that. The way that the term medieval is used in various ways to connote especially something that's bad, right? So you have medieval factory conditions or something like that, which is a weird connection if you kind of think about it, because I mean, like the idea of factories in the Middle Ages, not so much, but you know, we can put that adjective on it. So we had collaborated on a piece for the Washington Post in very early 2019, and we talked a little bit even before then about like, you know, we should write something bigger together, like maybe write a book together, but we kind of had no idea what it would be. And then later that year, I was in London for a conference. There was a phenomenal exhibition called Anglo-Saxon Kingdoms at the British Library that I attended. It was glittering. It was golden. It was vibrant manuscripts. It was so packed with color. And I walked out, as these museums do, as they shuffle you into the gift shop. And, you know, there were like trinkets and things like that. But the books on display, like they were very focused on that topic. But the general histories of the Middle Ages, they were talking about kind of this, they were peddling this myth of the Dark Ages. You know, this persistent idea of the medieval period as kind of bereft of learning, as kind of out, you know, beyond sourcing or, you know, just really troubling to kind of get a handle on. And it just wasn't the exact same thing that I had just seen. And so I remember this very distinctly. I was standing in the bookstore and like pulling out my phone and messaging David and said, like, we should write a book about the Middle Ages. And David wrote back and he said,
we should call it The Bright Ages. I mean, I've been thinking about this phrase, the Bright Ages, and I'm not the first person in human history to think, oh, the Dark Ages, we should call it the Bright Ages. But I had been thinking about it for a long time. And I think, just as Matt says, there is an image in popular culture of the European Middle Ages that is completely alien to the one that every professional medievalist studies, that we study something that is just not the image of the Middle Ages that exists. And it's existed for centuries. This Dark Ages thing, we talk about this in our book. It really pops up explicitly, an era of darkness in the 14th century with the Italian poet Petrarch, and has kind of continued ever since and has been picked up by different people with different agendas at different times. We talk about that as well. But that's a long running kind of mischaracterization of 1,000 years of human history in a pretty big chunk of the world. I mean, Europe's not, you know, it's still this continent. It's a pretty big chunk of the world. And it's just not what we, as people who study this period, see. So that's been bugging me and bugging every medievalist I know kind of since the jump. And suddenly Matt sent me this message and that was it. I knew, like, we're going to do this. We're going to try to do this book. And here we are.
That's great. And one of the things I love about it is how well that title does sum up the argument. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the title and about the idea of light in the Middle Ages as a sort of like counter image to this popular image of the Dark Ages. I know in the book that you get into the idea that light was central to art and architecture, as well as metaphors used in theology and literature. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to do. And one of the things we'd like to emphasize is that brightness is not just good. We're not trying to create a kind of recuperative anti-darkness where everything was great. That story about the Middle Ages also exists in popular culture in various ways and is equally troubling. But about brightness, and that it was a world of color, and that color can come from fire. We talk about the burning of the Talmud in Paris, and it can come from some of the most beautiful works of art or ideas about art and light that any human has ever produced. You know, I started my academic career working on the city of Venice, and in particular, the stories about Venice in religious texts and in religious art. And if you've ever been to Venice, if your listeners have ever been to Venice, you know, San Marco, this medieval church, really, it's a medieval church. It's a church that stands between East and West in these amazing, interesting ways. And it is covered in gold. It is literally covered in gold. It glows at all times of day. It glows. And if you think about it by candlelight or by torchlight or by sunlight, it glows. And medieval people thought about this too. We talk about this abbot, Abbot Suger, who was a very important 12th century, not just religious figure, but political figure. He was sort of regent of France for a little while. But he redesigned this church to emphasize the greatness of the French monarchy. But he also covered it in gold and gems, and he wrote about it. He wrote about the ways in which beauty exists. Sometimes in America, I think we imagine that rich and wealthy religious figures are hypocrites, right? That they talk about poverty, but they live in luxury, they live in mansions. And that was a debate in the Middle Ages too. But Suger, in fact, lived very simply and kind of almost performatively simply, but he decorated his world and wrote about the ways in which beauty transports the viewer into the presence of God, that he had a real theory of beauty as part of his religious and pastoral practice. And he's really explicit about it, but he's not particularly unusual about it, right? We have these stained glass, which is one of the most kind of indelible medieval features, and people think about it. But then they also say, oh, but the Dark Ages at the same time. And you can't have a world with a stained glass and sunlight pouring through colored glass and you know, casting you know, radiant light everywhere, and then also say the Dark Ages at the same time. You just can't have that. You can, however, have stained glass and violent images on the stained glass and both, you know, kind of transporting towards love and encouraging hatred. And both of those absolutely exist at the same time.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of sort of like an almost dialectical nature, I think, to the argument that like both these things can be true at the same time, right? Like one argument does not replace the other in terms of, you know, like the violence and the sort of beautiful imagery can exist side by side. And I think that yeah, the book is very nuanced and very just very convincing. Yeah, it's really great.
Phew. Glad to hear it.
I'd like to talk about one of them if we can. One of the earliest and most exciting ideas I think that you encounter in the book is the idea, and this is contrary to I think what a lot of us learn in our first history classes, the idea that the Roman Empire never fell. Can you talk a little bit about that, about the commonly held view about this, you know, transitional era between antiquity and the Middle Ages, and what you propose happened instead?
Yeah, sure. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a staple of kind of every world history, Western history course, even part of most medieval history curricula, be they, you know, kind of wherever you encounter them. You know, the Middle Ages kind of generally, and this is kind of what sparked our interest in that, the Middle Ages generally kind of suffer from a weird in-betweenness. I mean, it's called the Middle Ages, right? So it has to be between things. So it has a defined beginning and defined end. Right. And it's usually kind of the fall of Rome, quote unquote, at the beginning, and then this kind of Renaissance or Reformation, like some sort of fundamental change at the end of it. Antiquity, which comes before, doesn't really have a beginning. It has an end, right? Like if you follow that same schema. And modernity, in the same way, like it has a beginning, but it has no end. Like we're still living in that kind of period. So, you know, it has the Middle Ages has this kind of framework. And so one of the things we wanted to to do in this book is to talk about, like, well, what if we just asked a different question of these kind of seminal events, and that whether those smaller ones or larger ones. So this idea of the fall of Rome, in which the Western Roman Empire sort of succumbs to either invasions or kind of decadence or economic decline or something like that. That you emerge into a different kind of world because of that, and that's when we call it the Middle Ages. But by talking about, in our first chapter, actually in our introduction, and then in our first chapter, this figure of Galla Placidia, we can show, I think, that these moments that seem to signal the fall of Rome, on the lived experience, like, there's more continuity than change. And so we need to figure out, like, yeah, things are kind of different now than they were then, but, like, okay, so why are they different and how are they different? And so by showing, this or focusing on this particular figure, I think this is one way that we wanted to change that. The other thing that this does, and I think this is really important for what we wanted to do, is that this was a woman. Right, is that these narratives about the fall of Rome, they talk about generals and they talk about emperors. They talk about, dead white men. And those dead white men are important, and they certainly show up a lot in our book as well. But, like, Galla Placidia was an important figure in her own right, and it was representative of the fact that, 50% of the people in the past were women as much as they are today, right? Like, that's a thing, and we need to acknowledge that. And if we're not telling a full story about connectivity across the Mediterranean world, the way that politics function at the imperial level, but also at the local level, the way that culture and religion kind of move and shape this society, then we're not doing our jobs as historians, which is to tell a full picture of the lived experience of the past.
And just to jump in there, the other thing, of course, is that the Roman Empire continues in Constantinople, as it had since the 300s. So, before our book starts until 1453, which is in fact after our book ends in one way, we do go a little past there, but that's an extra 1,000 years, and everyone in the Middle Ages knew it. If you'd say, had the Roman Empire fall, they would have said, no, it's over in Constantinople. Or later they would have said, no, it's us if you're the Venetians, or it's us if you're the Frederick Barbarossa or something, they would have answered no. Would they have said, yes, Rome used to extend its political, military, legal authority all the way to Britain, and now it doesn't? Some people might have said that. That's true. But if you had asked them if it had fallen, they would have said no, because it's right over there. It's not a secret that it's right over there. They know it's there the whole time.
Yeah, I thought it was really fascinating about how many of the cultures that sort of succeeded, this period that we're talking about, cast themselves as the new Rome, about how that image came up over and over again. And what do you think that the mobilization of Rome in that way is doing for these different cultures?
I'm going to start, and then I'm going to pass it over to Matt, because this really gets actually into something he's really good at. But I want to start by saying, I think that medieval people and lots of other people too saw time as very cyclical and are always looking as a way to kind of look for things that came before and place themselves in things that are both recurring and then also looking at a linear process. So Rome becomes one way of marking who you are in relationship to the stories about this empire. And of course, it also then kind of gives the lie to the whole idea of the Renaissance of, well, they forgot about Rome and now we're getting it back. When in fact, again, throughout the 1,000-year period, there's a constant reference of themselves to Rome. So when we look at political figures, political, not figures, individuals, but entities, there's always a kind of a reference to where they are in position to this story of Mediterranean power from the centuries before them. But of course, it's bigger than that. And one of the things that we also look at is how that works in sacred time. And I'd love, Matt, can you jump in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I'll add there is that, authority, right, is really important, but it's not authority in kind of the sense in the medieval world, medieval Europe, is not authority kind of as we think of in the modern world. It doesn't come from institution. It comes from ideas and from people. So when people said Rome, like, that meant something to them. And so that's one way of kind of shorthanding a particular claim, and that could be political or cultural or religious or something like that. Because the other thing that Rome continues to be important for when you say Rome is the Bishop of Rome, right, is that, you know, that that changes very dramatically between the early Middle Ages and the later Middle Ages. But, you know, that that religious authority that derives from, you know, in theory, like St. Peter and that tradition, that becomes really important, especially later on. The other thing, too, it was that, as David was saying, kind of related to sacred time, and I guess this is kind of tied in with what I was saying about the Bishop of Rome, is that this idea of you know, you have this notion of kind of overlapping temporalities or ways of conceiving of time, in that people understood that, like, one thing happens after another and things happen before and things happen after and stuff like that. Like, that's not revolutionary to say that. But at the same time, I keep saying time, but at the same, in the same way, they also understood that time functions at a different level within the context of Christianity, is that there is a beginning of time and there is an end of time when, you know, Jesus would return, the heavenly Jerusalem would descend, the last judgment would occur and stuff like that. But with between that beginning and an end, especially after the end of kind of the gospel story, is that sacred time is kind of a mess. And so one of the things that you can do in order to figure out kind of where you are on that timeline is to locate yourself by important markers. Rome was one of those markers. And so to return to Rome, or to claim to return to Rome, was in some ways to claim that you were participating in sacred history in some kind of fundamental way. And this isn't, again, like, it's not, they're not making claims that they're themselves prophets necessarily, or that they themselves can divine God's will, but it's a way of, again, linking themselves to a particular type of authority. And so I think that's why you see Rome happening again and again and again. They're not saying it in the same way every time, but that is a constant that you see kind of moving across the period that we're studying.
Yeah, I'm really interested in this idea of sacred time and how it perhaps relates to the sources that you use in your book, especially the narrative sources, because I know that that sort of sacred time framework colors the way that history was written in the past, right? When these people were writing about these events themselves, they were imagining themselves as somewhere on this sacred timeline between, like, the beginning and the end of time. I was wondering, how do you use sources like that as a modern historian? And how do you perhaps supplement them with some of your other sources that you use? Because I was really interested in the material sources that you use as well, and how, you know, texts and material objects can work together.
Yeah. Well, I'll start, and then maybe David can jump in to talk about the materiality thing, because that's really kind of his wheelhouse. Is, but the narrative sources, you know, I think you see this kind of come through. And one of the things, before I actually give you the specific example, is that you've really hit on something we really tried to emphasize throughout the book, is to make those sources transparent. That there are a lot of sources from medieval Europe that you can access, that we as scholars can access in the original languages, but that exist in translation nowadays. So if people want to learn more, we heartily encourage them, read Procopius, read Marie de France, you know, read Dante, etc. Like, and you'll get more of a sense of that period than perhaps even we were able to convey. But kind of going back to your question about kind of how sacred time works, my favorite example of this is there's a chronicle of the First Crusade. So the First Crusade, starting in theory in about 1095, when the Pope, Urban II at the time, calls for a holy war to retake the city of Jerusalem. And impossibly the Christians do it. It seems like a miracle, because you look at the facts on the ground, like, it's kind of surprising that they're able to kind of pull this off. And there's lots of factors by why they do that, and a lot of writing. And in fact, in the 12th century, immediately after the taking of Jerusalem, there's kind of this explosion of history writing in medieval Europe itself to try to explain what's happened, because they kind of realize how weird it is, and how to them, how miraculous this event was. But one of these chronicles is by a guy by the name of Robert the Monk. He was probably associated with the monastery of Reims in northern France and stuff like that. In his prologue, he says very explicitly, this is the most important moment in sacred history since the death of Jesus Christ. Now, that's quite a claim to make, right? Like, as this narrative historian of this monk living in kind of northern France. But what he's doing there, and then he goes on to kind of describe, you know, if you read it from that introduction kind of forward and pay attention to it, he's trying to link it back into sacred history, to show how this is a moment that is much like what is something that has happened in the past, but is fundamentally different from that in this really important way. And then he kind of describes it. Now, this isn't something that like we've invented. Like, it's right there in the text, and Robert's not like shy about it. And so all of our sources are trying to tell us a story. And so I think that throughout the book, when we cement our particular chapters, the stories that we're telling in these sources, we're trying to give them voice and to listen to them and not to be kind of naive about what they're trying to tell us, but to at least acknowledge, like, this is the story that Procopius wanted to say. This is the story that Marie is trying to get across with these short kind of fantastical stories and stuff. So that's kind of the narrative stuff, and I'll give it to David to talk about the materiality.
Can you restate kind of what you wanted to know about the materiality? I was listening to Matt and lost my train of thought.
Sure. I was curious about how you use material sources alongside textual sources and whether you find that they supplement what the texts say or they challenge what the texts say, or, you know, how do you use them together?
Sure. I mean, medieval people, like all people, lived in a world in which stories were told, things were documented. I sort of primarily through oral matter for a long time, people, you know, saying things. There's a, I can't remember who said it. It was a comment at a conference, but someone sort of said the oral histories and the oral literature, that this is the dark matter of the Middle Ages. It makes up like 95% of everything that was ever said or told or, you know, in the Middle Ages. We can't see it. We can't touch it. We just get the 5%. You know, we get the rest of it. So, you know, they lived in a world of stories. They wrote things down. They made objects. They used objects to tell stories. They used objects to communicate. Objects communicate on their own, regardless of their intention, as they move and circulate. People lived in a world of all of the senses, and they engage with things in all of the senses. There's a plaque, a marble plaque. It's pretty big. It's about the size of a chalkboard, if in an old school, maybe not, you know, it's pretty big. It has the pictures of five relics, all of which in theory were taken out of the city of Constantinople in the Fourth Crusade and brought to Venice. And it hangs between the ducal palace and the chapel of the Duke, which is also now known as San Marco. And I've seen it. You can't go see it because it's closed off, but I got a guard to unlock it. And we pulled some platforms off it and some ladders. It was sort of amazing and appalling. Then he just left me alone. And the bottom layer at about waist height is worn smooth because of, you know, thousands, hundreds, I don't know, people running their hand along it. And I was left alone. I did it too. I mean, it's fine. It's marble, right? But they lived in a world in which they touched things and smelled them and tasted them. And to the extent that we can bring the reader into that full world, we're doing a better job of saying that they lived in color, right? We don't mean it just in terms of set of sight, but all the senses. But the other thing is that visual storytelling is really powerful, that many of the texts that survive, you know, medieval people wrote things, lots of medieval people could read. We have both secular and sacred texts. We have texts that were sort of for intellectuals and texts that were intended for much broader audiences. But there is a lot of the population that either couldn't or didn't read or certainly didn't engage that, but saw things and saw stories on the walls or heard sermons that might reflect it. So it's really vital to get into to get in that framework. The other thing about material objects, I mean, I've spent a lot of years engaging in sort of this world of materiality in the Middle Ages in my scholarship too, is that objects move in ways that other things, as in ways that other things or peoples might not. So we talk about, you know, some pretty remote parts of Europe as still connected to the bigger world, as still the word we like to use is permeable, this permeable medieval Europe where things go in and things come out by stuff that travels, whether it's coconuts in medieval England or whether it's Islamic coins in far Scandinavia or whatever else it is. Things move and meanings move with them. And leave evidence behind that as historians we can access.
I'm so glad that you brought up coconuts. That leads me to one of my questions is that, you know, as somebody who has been following medieval Twitter for a while, I noticed that you cite a lot of scholars who are also on Twitter and that you two also have, you know, your own pretty significant Twitter followings. And I was wondering about how online spaces like Twitter have helped you grow your scholarship or how you feel like that contributed to this project?
Sure. I mean, it's definitely true that many of our favorite academics, but surely not all of them, are on social media. And it helps us maintain a kind of conversation in between pre-COVID, the conferences, and in between the physical meetups. You know, Matt lives on a mountain in Virginia. I lived in Chicago for a long time, but I was at a very small school with three other medievalists. Social media, and then we'd see each other at conferences. That is how Matt and I became friends, we think. We don't even remember. But social media allows us to continue those conversations. I remember I was at a conference where I went to a party and hung out with a bunch of literary critics at a party just because it was in the same hotel and they were nice. And then we went home, and without social media, I wouldn't have seen them again for a year. But with social media, I started hearing about their publications and seeing what they were reading. And I started reading, they're thinking really kind of deep theoretical thoughts about the nature of objects and narratives related to objects at a high level that I'm not at. But I was watching them sort of perform this scholarship with each other, and it just gave me new things to read, new books, new ideas, new language that changed my scholarship. So I think that's really important. The other thing is Twitter can operate, if imperfectly, as a way to do a lot of public outreach and teaching outside the classroom. Classrooms are amazing. They're an amazing space, and it is by far the most important thing, kind of public work that most academics do. Of course, lots of us, including me, I'm not in a classroom anymore. There's a big audience. So it's not just connecting with other scholars, but it's connecting with other scholars in kind of public spaces where there can be conversation and questions and discourse and arguments and debates, and sometimes people getting really mad at each other. And at its best, that's productive. And at its worst, it's not, just as with all social media. But I think that's it's really important. And just things like, I think Matt texted me in that anecdote from the British Museum. I think that's what it was. It might've been on Google Chat, but I think he texted me. But Matt and I, you know, we talked about the book on Twitter DMs. We wrote this book in isolation from each other, in a time of isolation from everyone, but through kind of the connectivity of the modern internet. And that's not, and we shared our writing with people we met through. You know, when we were looking for experts in various fields to look at our chapters and tell us what we got wrong, you know, some of them are just people we've known for a long time because they're connected to our fields, but sometimes they're on things that we really didn't know as well as scholars. And knowing there were experts out there that we could identify through social media made that process, I think, a lot richer.
Yeah, and the only thing I'll add too is just to emphasize something David said is about the COVID-ness of the book. Not that the book has COVID. Okay, still go buy the book. It doesn't have COVID. Or check it out from your local library, I should say. But that we didn't intend this. We started the book. We conceptualized the book. We sold the book. The book was commissioned before the pandemic happened. But then we ended up having to do a lot of the writing during COVID. And so what social media allowed us to do was to enhance our scholarship. And what I mean by that is, like, we didn't have full access to libraries. We couldn't get a hold of some of the stuff that we would need in order to do the research that goes into the book. And social media allowed us to do that. Like, there were many times where David and I would say, like, hey, does anybody have a PDF of this article? Or does anybody know anything about this subject? And then all of a sudden, there were experts, right? And that they were generous with their time and their energy. And, you know, it really does, in its best, social media creates scholarly or intellectual community, as David was saying. And that became especially important as we were all kind of, you know, trapped in our houses. So.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So I was going to ask if you think that these online spaces became more important in the COVID era, in a way, like sort of supplementing or even in some cases, maybe replacing, you know, conferences that got canceled, for instance, or something like that.
Say there, it also made a lot of this more accessible. In one of my other hats, I do a lot of work around disability and access. And I think, you know, taking these conversations into spaces that more people can see them. When I say access, I'm thinking about disability, but it easily could be for financial reasons. You know, I went to a great conference in 2004 in Istanbul that really, really changed a lot for me. It was really powerful, but I did have to get a plane ticket to Istanbul and stay there. And you know, that's not accessible in any framing of the word to most people. And so, so I think COVID has really shown what's possible. I think we're a long way to knowing what that looks like in a post-COVID era, but we're also a long way from a post-COVID era. So we have some time to work that out.
Yeah, that's very true. We're in an interesting kind of period where, it's hard to say what I think these traditional academic spaces are going to look like going forward. That's super interesting. So I have one last question for you both, if that's okay. I was wondering if you had a particular chapter that was near and dear to your heart and why. Was there one that was most fun to write or perhaps most challenging to write?
I'll take that one first. I mean, they're all our children, and so we love them all equally. I have to say that, first of all. But I think that I have two. I'll cheat a little bit, and I'll say that I have two. The first is the chapter 6, I think it is, which is about Charlemagne's elephant. Or at least it starts with an anecdote about an elephant. Because one of the focuses of my work alongside kind of working on the Crusades is this group or this ruling family called the Carolingians. And so I loved being able to talk about that, especially because that chapter, I think, shows both kind of the political, cultural, social ambitions of an age, and at the same time, the failure of those ambitions. I think it would make an amazing prestige TV series someday, is to talk about the Carolingians, especially the end of that. So if you know you have any producers listening, then please get in touch. I have some script ideas. So that one I think is really amazing. The other one is, I can't remember the chapter number, but it's on Marie de France. And because I love Marie de France so much. She's one of very few female authors that we have from that particular period. We don't know a ton about her, but she's left us these amazing writings, a series of short kind of fantastical stories that we call Lays. And then there's also a book called The Fables as well. But we focus on the Lays, and we use that as a thread through the labyrinth of the 12th century, in which there's all these political and religious developments going on. We talk about Eleanor of Aquitaine and King Henry II. You may know them from that great movie Lion in Winter, for example, but also of Hildegard of Bingen, who's kind of, you know, has her own afterlife as well. And those lays, those stories, you know, they're so rich and interesting, and they're so delightful to read, and they're so easily available, anywhere. So I think those kind of stories about the Middle Ages, they illustrate so much, both again the good and the bad, and that's why they're so near and dear to my heart.
I'd say the most difficult chapter for me to write. I mean, there's a couple different ways of answering that. There's a chapter on early Islam that was difficult to write because it's one of the most powerful, huge, world sweeping stories of the era, and I wanted to do it in 3,000 words. And often the key was to figure out what is the Bright Ages narrative. And the Bright Ages narrative is not the story of early Islam, which is, again, really important. And there are lots of amazing books written on that alone. But to say that by the time we hit the 8th century, Islam is a medieval European religion. It is obviously not only a medieval European religion, but it is one. And it's going to be one for the rest of our time. So that was really hard to write just from a composition perspective, to figure out what do you do with this 200,000 word story when you have 3,000 words. The other one that was really important to me to get right and really difficult was on Maimonides. Maybe it's chapter 10 or 11. Maimonides was Jewish. He was born in Spain. He ends up really as a kind of war refugee in Egypt, then becomes the leader of the Jewish community in Cairo, becomes the doctor to Saladin, one of the sort of the most important figures of the period, this emperor. But he also is a philosopher, and he writes a book on the nature of God, basically. And, you know, the biggest question, what is God? And what does that mean for us? And it is a huge abstract question. So the challenge is, first of all, am I smart enough to explain Maimonides? Am I smart enough to understand him and explain him? That the jury's out on that. But also, and it is true that with this, each one of us drafted a chapter first. Someone has to write the sentence first. I think by the time now, we didn't tell you, I don't think you'd be able to tell who wrote which chapter when. I think we've worked really hard and we've got a lot of practice. But I did draft that one first. How do I make a general reader care about Maimonides and abstract theological questions? Mm-hmm. And again, it was figuring out, well, why this of all, other than I really think it's important, you know, me, David, why this? And it's really about that it's a story about permeability of ideas, that by the end of the chapter, I'm tracing arguments about God and Aristotle and commentaries on God and Aristotle and you know, commentaries on the commentaries of people arguing from Iran to Egypt, to Iberia, to Italy, through Islamic, Jewish, and Christian voices writing in many different languages. And that, you know, it's not as fast as Twitter, to kind of to circle back to the last question, but it's pretty fast. It's within a century, these ideas move from Central Asia to Iberia, thousands of miles away, and back again and across. And Maimonides is a central figure in that, and is Jewish. And that was really important for me to center a chapter on him and Jewish community. But that's the story, right? I hope people study medieval philosophy for its own sake. But what I hope readers take from it, and this took us a while to get to, is the way that ideas move as well as people, as well as things, and that we can trace it, we can prove it, we can show it to you.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to say that Maimonides is a great figure for examining, I think, a lot of the through lines of your book about how, we have this old view of the Middle Ages as being very isolated and fragmented and shut off, when it was actually a very interconnected world in which people and objects moved pretty freely. And I do think he's like a really fascinating figure to sort of discuss that idea through.
For sure. Absolutely. And also just things like, you know, we have these incredible sources from medieval Cairo that is the subject of a whole different podcast and lots of other wonderful books. But, you know, one of the sources we have is about Maimonides' brother, David, who goes off into the Indian Ocean and sadly drowns in a shipwreck. He's a merchant. But again, that brings the Indian Ocean world, again, it doesn't even bring it into the book. It opens the door and says, the Indian Ocean was there the whole time too. Sub-Saharan Africa was there the whole time too. That, you know, wherever we look, there are peoples and there are humans, there are societies and humans doing human things, and that there are ways to know them. And even though this book is doing one particular set of that, we hope that there are lots of visible pathways out of our book towards the next big question.
Well, this has been absolutely great. Thank you so, so much for coming to discuss your book with me and our listeners. I really appreciate it.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. This has been Jen with Turn the Page podcast, in discussion with Matthew Gabriel and David Perry, authors of The Bright Ages, which is one of my favorite books of the year that you should absolutely definitely check out. Thank you so much for listening. And for now, we are going to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.